Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How accurate are public perceptions of the risks and benefits of childhood vaccinations? A 1998 study published in the British medical journal The Lancet seemed to show a link between the shot given to toddlers to protect them against measles, mumps, and rubella and the rising occurrence of autism in children. That was enough to convince many parents that the risks of vaccines far outweighed potential benefits. But the study's conclusions were never duplicated in independent research. And as flaws, abuses, and alleged fabrications in the original paper mounted, Andrew Wakefield lost his license to practice medicine in the UK, and The Lancet retracted the original paper nearly a year ago formally. Last week, a published analysis declared that paper an out-and-out fraud. Still, fears about vaccines remain high among some parents, even as rates of once rare diseases in the developed world, including measles, mumps, and whooping cough, have risen and taken dozens of lives. So where does the truth lie? Seth Mnookin, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, set out to find it and reports his conclusions in the new book, The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Seth, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So you got interested in this subject around the time you started thinking about becoming a parent yourself. Can you talk about what you found as you began to ask around?
It was actually even a little bit before that. A lot of my friends were either having children or thinking about having children or had young children, and I was newly married, and I started hearing a lot about this debate that I had pretty much been unaware of. This was right around the time that Jenny McCarthy began speaking publicly about her belief that vaccines had harmed her son, Evan. And what struck me at the time was that this was not a subject about which there seemed to be disagreement about interpretation of the facts. It was something where there was disagreement about what the actual facts were, and that really struck me, and that was something I wanted to look at more.
Yeah, you describe in the book the kind of people you met who had serious concerns about vaccine safety, and I'm talking about lay people here, other parents and things like that, and overwhelmingly they seem to be well-educated, intelligent people. When you describe them, I think it's on page 10 in the book, they sound a lot like the average NPR listener.
Yes. I think that's exactly right. In fact, at one point I asked an official from the California Department of Public Health how he went about trying to identify communities that were at higher risk for having low vaccine uptake. And he said, only half jokingly, take out a map, put a pin where all of the Whole Foods are, and draw a circle around that, and that's where you're likely to see a lot of this sentiment. It tends to be parents who are very involved in child rearing, parents who are, as you said, highly educated, affluent, environmentally concerned, and that was another thing that struck me, because just taking the issue of environmentalism, these were people who were very dismissive of those that they felt were ignoring the scientific facts regarding global warming. Mm-hmm. And yet here was a sort of parallel scenario in which there did seem to be clear facts supporting vaccine safety, and they sort of felt like, well, my instinct overrides that. I should say that when I started this, I actually did not know which side might have more validity. And I thought, well, since I don't have a horse in this race, it would be an interesting project to go about.
So there's this landmark paper that we now have all heard about, published in 1998 in The Lancet, which is a highly respected, peer-reviewed medical journal, seemed to prove a link between the MMR vaccinations recommended, I think it's 15 months old, and the rise in diagnoses of autism. Can you tell us a little bit about what that study consisted of?
Sure. As you said, this was in 1998, and it was a study that was the actual content of the study really involved a question of whether the measles component of the MMR vaccine could possibly cause gut disorders in children. And that had been a topic that the lead researcher, Andrew Wakefield, had been focusing on in one degree or another for quite some time. And there was some speculation in the paper about whether there could be a connection between those gut disorders and autism through some rather convoluted pathways. The paper itself really bent over backwards to indicate that this was entirely speculative. It was a topic about which more research was needed. But then when there was a press conference announcing the paper, Andrew Wakefield went much, much further and recommended that parents actually hold off on giving their children the 3-in-1 measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. So that really right from the get-go, the controversy and what was there in the scientific literature diverged. It turned out that there were a lot of problems with even that initial paper. But one other point, which I think is worth making about that paper, is it was based on a dozen children, on just 12 children, and it was what's called a case series. And case series are really used as a jumping-off point for further studies. There are a number of different reasons why a case series might seem to indicate one thing, and then when you looked at it a little further, it might not. One of those is just randomness. An example I use in my book is, if a Martian came down on Earth and was trying to figure out the differences between the proportion of boys and girls born to Earthlings, it would be very easy to take a couple of families that had a much higher percentage or one of the other. And if you were making conclusions off of a case study, you would then assume that that same proportion held across the population as a whole, which clearly is not true.
So as you mentioned, it's a sort of a jumping off point. And in fact, multiple attempts were made to replicate these results or to test them. Is that correct? With larger groups of children?
Yes, that is correct. Before the paper was even published, the editor of the journal The Lancet had sufficient concerns about it to commission several other scientists to essentially write in the same issue why the paper was wrong, which was extremely rare and is extremely rare. Usually when you have a commentary on a paper that appears in a journal, the commentary is there to talk about how incredible the study is, not how unreliable it is. In the years to come, you saw the type of studies that are more accurate, and that's population-wide epidemiological studies. So scientists would take a population where there were very clear health records, compare the rates of autism in children who had and had not received the vaccine. This was done again and again and again, as were other types of tests and experiments. And everyone uniformly came back in support of vaccine safety, with the exception of some other studies that Andrew Wakefield was directly involved with.
Now, when you say vaccine safety, we should say for a minute that medical professionals will acknowledge that all vaccines carry with them some risk, not necessarily of autism, but of complications. Can you speak to that so we make sure we have it on the table?
Sure. That's true. In the same way that everything carries some risk, aspirin carries some risk, milk carries some risk, wearing a seatbelt carries some risk. There's some tiny proportion of people who, as a result of wearing a seatbelt, are injured, suffer internal injuries. So there's really nothing in life that does not carry some risk. Because vaccines are the type of public health measure where, when they're effective, it's very difficult to sort of intuitively understand the potential consequences of not vaccinating. When people hear there is some risk, I think that instead of looking at that in the context of everything that we experience in our day-to-day lives, that sounds like a decision between not vaccinating, where there are no potential consequences, and vaccinating, which could harm your child. So I think that's important. That's important for people to understand.
Let's talk about that for a minute. And I think you state it really well in the book. You say the more effective vaccines are, the less necessary they seem. The reality is that parents of our generation were not alive at a time when these diseases, uncontrolled, were killing children in scores.
Yes. I think, I don't have any personal experience with people who had polio, who either now are paralyzed or who didn't live. Unfortunately now I'm starting to know people whose children have died of whooping cough, but that wasn't a disease that was on my radar before I started working on this, and before there have been some whooping cough outbreaks over the last couple of years. So I do think that has really come into play. And another factor has been what I think is really the inability of the media to present this story accurately. One claim you hear regarding vaccines is that we now vaccinate against dozens of diseases. It's too many vaccines given too soon. And that's just not accurate. We don't vaccinate against dozens of diseases. We vaccinate against 10 or 11. So when people make those claims on television, in print, on the radio, a lot of times that is framed as, okay, well, now what do you think, Mr. Official from the CDC? And I don't think that's really a legitimate way to frame what is clearly a factual issue. I compare it a little bit to the coverage of the birther movement, where you had media outlets saying, oh, okay, well, you believe that Obama was not born in the United States, and on the other side, we have his birth certificate and all of the evidence that indicates that he was. By presenting that as a sort of he said, she said situation, I think it gave what should not have been a legitimate topic of discussion much more legitimacy.
One of the dads that you talked to said something like, it just seems like too much for an infant's immune system to handle. And this was not a scientist. It was just someone who had that sense.
Right.
It's funny, Seth, because parents are so often told to trust their instincts. And in this case, we're saying trust the science.
Right. Well, I think that one of the things that's really interesting to me about instinct and about what does or doesn't seem possible to us at any given moment, or whether it does or doesn't seem safe to give children vaccines, is that our notion of what's realistic and possible is incredibly fluid. It wouldn't have been that long ago that beaming movies around the world into something that's the size of a pack of playing cards in your pocket would have seemed like something out of science fiction. It was only a couple of several generations ago that airplanes would have seemed like the most fantastical notion.
Let me have you pause there. We're going to take a quick break. Seth Mnookin is my guest. His new book is called The Panic Virus, a true story of medicine, science, and fear. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Seth Mnookin. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and author of the new book, The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I want to talk here for a minute about thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative. It early on was thought that perhaps that could have some kind of detrimental effect and be causing this uptick in cases of autism. That's actually been out of the MMR since 2002, is that right?
It actually wasn't in the MMR vaccine.
Okay.
It was in some other childhood vaccinations. It was in some variations of the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine, some variations of the Hib vaccine, but it was not in the MMR. And what happened was in the late 90s, there was a bill, a much more general bill involving mercury in the environment. And as a result, for the first time, public health officials tallied up the maximum amount of this preservative that an infant could receive if they got all of the variations of the vaccinations that did have thimerosal in it. And that amount was higher than some recommendations for safe levels of mercury. It's important to note that the preservative, thimerosal, is ethyl mercury, and the mercury in tuna, for example, and that we know is dangerous, is in methyl mercury. That sounds like not a big difference, but the difference between methyl alcohol and ethyl alcohol is one gets you drunk and one kills you. So it doesn't take a lot to make a significant difference. That said, I think it's incredibly irresponsible that those tests, those studies on the cumulative effects, had not been done before that point. There were legitimate reasons why the American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC was confident that it was safe. The main one being that there had not been any indications that there were problems with children being vaccinated. But I think it's inexcusable that those studies hadn't been done before. Since then, you're absolutely right. Thimerosal has been removed from childhood vaccines, so it's not an issue that parents right now need to even think about. And there have been studies on literally millions of children regarding thimerosal that have also indicated that did not pose a risk. So I think it's another one of those, it's an example of when a fear is sort of introduced into a population. It's very, very hard to get rid of that. It's much easier to scare someone than to unscare them.
I have to tell you, your book is scary. It opens with a scene of a very sick child. And as a parent, it's scary to think about a child getting one of these diseases. A lot of people assume that childhood diseases are not so dangerous.
Yeah, and I have to say, I found talking to parents whose children had gotten sick or died from diseases like whooping cough or Hib just to be excruciatingly painful. And the book starts with the story of a mother named Kelly Lasik who had heard rumors that vaccines were dangerous and so did not vaccinate one of her sons, who then came down with what she thought was a sore throat or strep throat, took him to the hospital. And within hours, literally, he was in a medically induced coma because they thought he was going to die from Hib. And he remained in a coma for days. He is, thank goodness, now okay. I think that is a terrifying story. And there are many examples of children that are not okay. 10 kids last year in California died of whooping cough. Not because they had not been vaccinated, but because they were too young to have gotten a vaccine. And that's a risk when you have diseases reemerging in populations. You put infants, you put the elderly, you put people for whom vaccines aren't effective at risk for some very scary diseases.
Yeah, talk about the concept of herd immunity and how many of us need to be vaccinated to protect those who, for a variety of medical reasons, cannot be.
Well, the concept of herd immunity is that if enough people in a community are immune to a disease, that disease can't get a toehold and can't spread. So even if somehow you had one case, it wouldn't be able to then go from person to person to person. Generally, depending on the disease, the levels of immunity that you need are between 90 and 95% to achieve herd immunity. And there are communities now across the country where the levels have fallen to 80, 70, 60%. And what's interesting and really important, I think, to remember about that concept is that you're not talking about a country or even a state. You really can be talking about a community as small as, you know, an individual school. That's what happened a couple of years ago with the measles outbreak in California. You had one unvaccinated student go travel to Switzerland with his family, was infected with measles, came back, and he was at a school that had a large number of unvaccinated children. Some other of those children caught the disease, and you ended up having an outbreak that cost $10 million to control and resulted in the hospitalization of an infant who was too young to have been vaccinated. So, you know, if you see, a statistic that says, well, in Texas, the overall vaccine uptake rate is 92 or 94%. That does not mean that your individual community is not at risk.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Gabriel in Wichita Falls. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi. I have a few questions. I'll try to be brief. Now that we know that Wakefield committed fraud, is that any type of a criminal action to commit fraud in a scientific study? Is there any movement to strip him of his ability to practice medicine in America? Is there any movement to hold the people who promoted this responsible, Wakefield, McCarthy, Winfrey, civilly or criminally? People have died. This is just horrible what they've done. Is anybody doing anything to hold them responsible for their actions?
What do you know about that, Seth?
Those are really, really fascinating questions. The first one is Wakefield actually lost his license to practice medicine in the UK a year ago. He was formerly associated with a clinic in Austin called Thoughtful House, but he never actually had the right to practice medicine in the U.S. He never was licensed in the U.S. So he was not seeing patients, or theoretically, and I don't know any different, he was not seeing patients there. He was involved more on the research and consulting side of Thoughtful House. So right now, he is not legally allowed to practice medicine anywhere. I have not heard and don't know how it would work of any efforts to prosecute him, but I'm not familiar with the legal system in the UK. I also don't know of any discussions of that type of legal action against people here, and I think it would be troubling if there were, because I think this is not a situation in which you have parents acting in anything but good faith. I think you have parents who believe that not vaccinating their children is the best thing to do, and partially because the story they've been getting from us, from the media, has been murky. The only place in which I've seen discussion of that actually was on a Law and Order episode where a child did die of measles and there was a prosecution against a family that was not vaccinated. But I don't know of any efforts to do that domestically.
What about this? There are people in the camp that is very concerned about vaccines being unsafe who say, okay, maybe for the vast majority of people, vaccines don't pose any harm. They don't pose any link to something like autism. But perhaps there's a segment of the population that for whatever reason is somehow genetically susceptible to harm from these. What do we know about that in terms of the science?
Well, what's interesting about that, I guess there are two things. One, that's a very recent argument. And it's one that really cropped up after every previous argument had been shown not to have validity. And it's a supposition that is untestable, which I think gives an indication of the fact that there's not a lot to suspect that it's true. Again, it's theoretically possible that there's some minuscule percentage of the population that's genetically susceptible to dying when they come in contact with grass. And it's such a small portion that we can't study it. Again, very, very unlikely. There have been more studies done on vaccines than any issue involving childhood public health. And there has never been an indication of genetic susceptibility or anything like that.
So why do you think the media have failed to communicate the science effectively? You point to the fact that a lot of newspapers and broadcasting outlets are cutting their science departments.
Right.
Is that it? There are no science experts left in the media?
I think that is one part of the problem, that you have a decline of expertise. I think another part of the problem is that science can be a difficult subject to explain and a difficult subject to grasp. The notion of not being able to prove a negative, which is a basic bedrock of science, is not an easy one. And the way that plays out is you can never prove that anything is safe 100%, just like you can never prove that I definitively will not be able to fly. All you can say is that all of the history and evidence and years of experience we have indicate that is not the case and will continue to not be the case. But it is theoretically possible that I could wake up tomorrow with the ability to fly. So that's a tough concept to communicate in a brief amount of time. I also think for whatever reason, science and medicine has been reported, has been dealt with in a way in which things without credence are given this sort of, on the one hand, on the other hand, treatment. And the excuse a lot of times is, well, this is a controversial story. This is something that people are talking about. That wouldn't fly in most other areas of coverage. If I said that Texaco was about to buy Apple computers, that would also be controversial and false. And if newspapers started writing that, they would be humiliated. They wouldn't be lauded for being first on a controversial story. So I think we need to sort of recalibrate the way that, as an industry, we think of science coverage and start to hold it to that type of standard instead of the idea that if you can get one person to say one thing and someone to say something else, then that's a legitimate thing to talk about.
So we're left here with the question of why rates of autism continue to climb, autism diagnosis. And there is a lot of people will say, well, we're diagnosing it better now, we're diagnosing it earlier.
Right.
But there has been this steady climb over a number of decades now. What was the sort of prevailing theory before people started thinking perhaps there's something in those vaccinations that could be causing a problem?
Well, first, I think, there is a lot of debate over what the increase is attributable to. And there is very, very good evidence that it is not, it cannot be attributed solely to different diagnostic criteria. So, you know, there's overwhelming evidence that there actually are rising rates. They're not rising as precipitously as it might seem because of all of those issues that you pointed out, but there is a real rise. Part of what makes this myth so pernicious is that we don't know. We don't know if it's a combination of genetic factors or environmental factors. We don't know if it has to do with the age of parents. There are a lot of questions that haven't been answered. And I think that that is actually one of the not very widely discussed tragedies of this, is that, you know, there's obviously a limited number of resources, a limited amount of money, a limited number of researchers who can look into these topics. And for a decade now, autism research has been dominated by repeating these studies regarding vaccines. And once that link had been definitively disproven, all that is money that could have and should have, I think, been used to look into other environmental factors and other potential causes and other potential treatments. You know, I think that no one would argue with the fact that parents dealing with children with disabilities do not get the support that they need in our society, don't get the institutional support, the financial support, and that is also a tragedy. And, you know, you have a lot of funds that went towards replicating work that I think could have and should have been used elsewhere.
Seth Mnookin is my guest. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and author of the new book, The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Seth Mnookin. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Jennifer in Dallas who wants to know, have there been studies comparing vaccinated versus unvaccinated children? And she doesn't indicate, but I'm assuming she means in terms of autism diagnosis rates.
That's a fascinating question, and it's one that comes up a lot in regards to you know, here's one way we could establish this one way or another. The answer there is yes and no. There have been studies where we have records, and this is especially in the Netherlands because they have really, really extensive health records. Comparing vaccinated children with children who did not receive any vaccines and looking at the rates of various diseases. In the U.S., you can't do that, and in fact, you can't work out that type of study, you can't plan that type of study anywhere because it would be unethical to ask one segment of the population not to receive vaccines. You know, you can't say forego this potentially life-saving treatment so that we can do this study. So as a result, when you have those type of studies, even when they do indicate that there's no connection with autism, then you have vaccine skeptics or anti-vaccine activists saying, well, that study isn't reliable because it wasn't a large enough sample size, or because the number of children that you were comparing who were vaccinated was so much higher to the number of children in the study who were unvaccinated. So again, I think it's a good, it's an illustration of the sort of no-win situation that we find ourselves in now.
With these issues of unvaccinated kids, and you mentioned the school, I think it was in California where there was a measles outbreak, how are people getting around? Aren't there laws in every state requiring school-age kids to have had certain shots?
There are. Most states, and possibly now every state, has a religious exemption where if vaccinating your child is goes against your religious beliefs, you can get a waiver. The anti-vaccine movement has lobbied successfully in many cases over the past decade for what's called philosophical exemption laws that only require you to say that you are philosophically opposed to vaccines. So the burden of proof, but the standard that parents need to adhere to in order to get around those school age regulations has changed a lot. And when you see these communities with very low uptake rates, that's why it is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Seth Mnookin. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with David in Lancaster. Hi, David.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I do have a question, like, more of a comment than a point, and I'd like to hear your guest's opinion on it.
Okay.
There's been a huge explosion in the number of vaccines that are given to children. I mean, it used to be you'd get 10 or 12 as a kid, and now it's over 30. And that could certainly be a problem. I have a significant problem with some of the vaccines as being totally unnecessary and driven by the greed of the drug companies. The varicella vaccine, chickenpox. Chickenpox is an overwhelmingly benign and non-damaging, easy disease to live with. Kids get it, they're immune for life, and it's over. 2 or 3 days, maybe a little longer, of itching and scratching, and we're done. But the drug company says, oh, we've got a vaccine for it, and they truck up the costs and the inconvenience of the disease, made it into the most horrible monster ever, and now it's mandated. And the biggest problem is that the disease, that the vaccine is short-lived. It only has a 5 to 10 year immunity, and then you have to get revaccinated. Or if you get chickenpox as an adult, now it's a devastating disease, causing brain damage, death, lots of problems. And this is some of the things that I think a lot of people are against, is some of these vaccines are unnecessary and driven by the greed of the medical and drug companies.
Well, let's get a response for you. What do you think about that, Seth?
That's a fascinating phone call, because I think it illustrates how you have a number of misconceptions out there. It's incredibly timely to address every one of them, and any given one of them sounds very scary. It is 100% false that there are 30-some-odd vaccines. The total number of recommended vaccines between 0 and 6 years old is 15, and that includes some that includes some like hepatitis A and hepatitis B, that there is some more leeway on. So to claim that there used to be only a dozen vaccines and now there are some 30-some-odd vaccines is absolutely false. There's no ambiguity about that. The issue about whether vaccines convey lifelong immunity or partial immunity is also not clear-cut the way the caller indicated it was. There are some vaccines that convey lifelong immunity. There are some, like the pertussis vaccine and the tetanus vaccine. Everyone probably remembers getting tetanus shots that do require boosters. That is just a reality of the situation. It doesn't mean those vaccines are any more or less safe or effective. Finally, saying that some of these diseases are less serious, I guess, is true in that some of them are not usually lethal. But there are children who have been made incredibly, incredibly sick by chickenpox, who have been blinded by chickenpox. There, you know, when you have a child with chickenpox, you need to stay home from work for a week or 10 days or get childcare. That's an enormous financial burden on many families. In fact, one of the fascinating things I found out was that there was a really pretty direct correlation between women in the workforce and the widespread use of vaccines, which is something I had not thought about at all. So it's really an issue of, you know, if there is something that can protect you against a disease like chickenpox, and if chickenpox can have really dire complications, what is the argument against it? I don't see one. You know, I understand how if there was evidence that the chickenpox vaccine was really dangerous, how you might then make a decision to forego that. But there just isn't. So, you know, I think it's setting it up like that is a false construct.
And the varicella vaccination is not required. Is that correct? It's still optional?
I actually don't know. I don't know. I know that the first dose of the varicella vaccine is not until after a child is a year old. But I don't know. I don't know if it's required or not. I'm looking at the CDC's chart of recommended immunization schedule for 0 to 6 years. But I don't know which of those are actual recommended vaccines and which are more mandatory under vaccination laws.
I'm America's only 40-year-old woman who's never had chickenpox, so this is a particular interest.
Right. Well, be careful. I know 40-year-olds who have gotten it, and
well, I had the shot.
Not fun is an understatement.
I had the shot, but now they're saying that it might need a booster later on. Anyway, how much money? Let's go back to David's point, which is this is a huge moneymaker for the pharmaceutical industry, and that point can't be denied. Am I correct?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's another sort of false equivalency there, which is you can't simultaneously believe that drug companies do not always have your best interests at heart, and that vaccines are safe. Drug companies have clearly behaved unethically in a number of different circumstances. There are instances where drugs were brought to market prematurely, where drugs are marketed for diseases that they shouldn't be marketed for. But that does not mean that everything that drug companies do it should also not be considered safe. And again, vaccines are an issue that in which we're not relying on drug companies to tell us that they're safe. We're relying on governments and scientists and doctors and researchers around the world who have all reached that conclusion. So, you know, I agree that drug companies should not necessarily be trusted. I don't think that means anything about this topic because they're not the ones who we need to trust in this instance.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with John in Plano. Hi, John.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'm 62 years old. I had polio in 1952, several years before the vaccine. I can promise you nobody that had polio or got exposed to it at that time would not wish to have had the vaccine. I'm really happy that he's writing this book. It's broken my heart to see so many of a younger generation not realize how devastating all the childhood diseases can be because they haven't gone through mass amounts of schools having to close because of the measles or somebody pregnant. It's all those can be very devastating. Given my choice, I certainly would have wanted to have the polio vaccine. I have a daughter who is 6 years old. I can assure you she's had all her vaccines. So I'm really very happy to see somebody has taken this false issue to task, because all those childhood diseases can be so very, very devastating.
Well, John, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. Seth, do you find that people are either far on one side of this issue or far on the other, or are there a lot of people remaining sort of on the fence that aren't sure what to believe?
I think that this is a difficult issue to have definitive opinions about and not feel incredibly emotionally about.
Mm-hmm.
People who have clearly formed opinions, I think for the most part, are not going to be convinced one way or another. One of the reasons I wrote the book is because the vast, vast majority of people fall into that middle camp who just don't know, who want to protect their children, who want to do the right thing, and find it hard to figure out what exactly they're supposed to do. And, not everyone can spend 2.5 years looking into this. And so one of the things that I hoped and that I hope is that, people can look at this book and say, okay, well, I'm not a doctor. No one in my family works for a drug company. No one is directly affected by autism. This was a topic I went into as a journalist who had not made up his mind. And so here is a really factually based account of the controversy and an account that you can trust.
Do you think that the analysis that emerged last week that said that the Wakefield study, at least, was a fraud, will that change anyone's mind?
I don't think it will change people's mind, again, who already feel very strongly one way or another. The people who support Wakefield, and I've talked to them, some of them in the past week, have interpreted that as further proof of the conspiracy against him. So I don't think that's ever going to change. One thing that I thought was really unfortunate about the way that was covered was that, again, too often the way that story was framed was, this paper was now revealed to be a fraud. Let's see what the two sides think.
Hmm.
And as point of fact, whether the paper was or was not ruled to be a fraud is really almost irrelevant, because the scientific data has been in for a decade. And by reintroducing it as a subject for debate, I think what it does, or what it did for a lot of people, was raise the question again in their mind. If this was settled so long ago,
I'm gonna have
why
to
are
jump
we
in.
Discussing it
yeah,
again?
We're out of time. Seth Mnookin's new book is called The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Seth, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.